You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Last year, President Obama signed an updated defense authorization bill that bans the use of torture in the United States. It came after years of increased media attention about the interrogation techniques used against detainees at the Guantanamo Bay military prison. In an article headlined, "Where Even Nightmares Are Classified, Psychiatric Care at Guantanamo," New York Times investigative reporter Sherry Fink wrote about the psychiatric department at the prison and how largely unaware doctors were to what was happening to the prisoners. It was published in The Times on November 12th. And in today's paper, Ms. Fink writes about a lawsuit against the two psychiatrists who were hired by the CIA to help devise and run the interrogation program. I'm very pleased they have brought Sherry Fink back to our show today. Welcome back.
Good to be with you.
You've previously covered stories about Ebola and Hurricane Katrina. How did you get involved in investigating what's going on in Guantanamo?
Well, I had looked at that a few years ago from the standpoint of the psychologists back in 2009. And then this year, a couple of my colleagues, Matt Apuzzo and Jim Risen, were working on a series that they brought me into. And the goal was to look at whether or not our country, when we said that the men who we were detaining and interrogating with these so-called enhanced interrogation techniques, that if those were used, they weren't going to cause any kind of lasting effect, lasting harm, because that's sort of part of the definition of torture. So what we did was go out, try to find a lot of those former detainees and find out about the ones, the 60 or, who are currently at Guantanamo, and find out, did undergoing those techniques leave no trace, or did it in fact have a lasting effect? And we ended up finding out that many of the men who underwent everything from, you know, the very extreme kind of what we call waterboarding or dousing with water to things like sleep deprivation, slapping, being pushed into flexible walls, all of those so-called extraordinary or enhanced interrogation techniques, we found that many of them are having lasting psychological problems, not surprisingly.
What kind of psychiatric care is provided at a military prison like Guantanamo Bay for people who have these lasting psychiatric problems?
So that's what had not really been looked at before. We've heard in recent years about the involvement of mental health professionals in helping to devise some of these techniques that were intended to extract information from detainees and try to avoid future terrorist attacks.
Which is the subject of your article in today's paper.
That's right. But what we hadn't known much about was this whole other set of mental health care providers, psychologists, psychiatrists, psychiatric nurses, who were, in the same sites that their colleagues were in, who were parts of the interrogations, but yet this other set of health professionals was there to provide mental health care. So here were people undergoing interrogations with the help of some psychologists, and on the other side, they'd get back to their cells, and there would be a team of mental health providers who were on site as part of the larger medical team, and their job was to treat any mental health problems, either that were resulting from the interrogations or just, a lot of the people who were picked up had mental health issues to begin with. We know now that a number of people were mistakenly identified, were sold in some cases for bounties. And of course, who's going to be most vulnerable? It would be sometimes, in some cases, people who had pre-existing mental health conditions. So the story, the classified nightmare story that you're talking about, it told the story of that really difficult job of being a psychologist, being a psychiatrist, and trying to provide mental health care for detainees.
Are the psychiatrists all military psychiatrists? What's the level of their expertise in this kind of these kinds of situations?
That's right. So Guantanamo, which the story focuses on, is a military prison. And so all of the health providers are part of the military, and so they're, but they described, I was able to find more than two dozen of them to speak with me, and they described feeling really unprepared for the job. A lot of them had not even worked in a prison or, you know, that kind of a setting before. They were told these were the worst of the worst kind of terrorists, which we now know wasn't always the case, was often not the case. They were very afraid, you know, sort of made to be very fearful of these people and to think of them as our enemies, America's enemies. And so there was a lot of maybe preparation on the security side, but not so much on the how do you provide care to people in this setting where you don't share a common language, you don't, you know, many of the people who were picked up in Afghanistan and other places, some of them didn't even really know what mental health care was or had very different ideas of what was causing their distress. There's a concept called jinns, and these are thought to be supernatural beings. And one of the psychiatrists said to me, she's, from Florida, and she said, I didn't know I was giving people antipsychotic medications when they were complaining of jinns bothering them. She didn't know what was sort of culturally part of explaining illness versus what was outside of that. And so these were just some of the many challenges that they faced.
Wasn't there an exorcism to get rid of one of those jinns?
There was a case that I write about in this classified nightmare story where it was actually, and this is what made the job even harder, was that when a detainee was at Guantanamo being subjected to a harsh interrogation that involved health providers. In this case, there was a case where as part of the interrogation, as part of some of those techniques that I talked about, the detainee, this was Katani, who we now know has now been found out that he had some pre-existing psychosis. And so he started seeing jinns as he was being sleep deprived, as he was being, made to believe he might be killed. And so he had psychiatric symptoms, and instead of taking him to the treating psychologist or psychiatrist, the interrogators themselves held an exorcism. Mm-hmm. So you could imagine in his case, this lasting effect of that kind of harsh interrogation, what has now been called torture in many cases by our country, how would that person ever know when to trust a psychiatrist anymore, particularly somebody in that same setting who's wearing a military uniform? So this was part of the complication, was kind of like the weaponization of psychology, is how one psychologist put it. The very act of asking questions, which is what we know, anybody who's been a therapist or watched one in a movie, it's part of doing therapy, part of recovering, has to do with questions and answers. Well, when you're being interrogated under those harsh conditions, that itself then comes back up when somebody's trying to do therapy with you.
And didn't the fact that they had to speak through translators undermine building of rapport with the detainees?
It did, and not
there are also
just
cultural differences of different detainees. I'm wondering whether psychiatrists were aware of all of those differences.
They weren't necessarily, and sometimes those translators could provide some of that cultural translation and help a psychologist or psychiatrist from America understand what was sort of normal and what wasn't. But the complication with the translators was not only in how competent were they, how good at their jobs they were, whether a detainee trusted them, but it was also the fact that there weren't that many translators. And what I was told by many of the psychologists and psychiatrists and former detainees was that those translators worked for both the interrogation teams and the medical teams. And that's a problem when it comes to sharing sensitive information. So this was yet another element of this huge barrier of trust between the mental health providers and their patients.
We're speaking with Sherry Fink of the New York Times, mostly about what she wrote about in an article called Where Even Nightmares Are Classified, Psychiatric Care at Guantanamo. It was in the November 12th issue of the New York Times. She also has a piece that she's co-written in today's paper about the two psychiatrists who were hired by the CIA to help devise and run the interrogation programs that these inmates then had to go speak to other psychiatrists about enduring. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Sherry Fink of the New York Times. Her article, Where Even Nightmares Are Classified, Psychiatric Care at Guantanamo, was in the November 12th issue of the New York Times. Who is Lieutenant Commander Shay Rosencrantz?
So Shay Rosencrantz is a retired psychiatrist, and she was in the Navy, and she deployed with one of the earlier teams, I think it was in 04 or 05, as the head of that behavioral health team. So as a psychiatrist, she had a couple of psychologists and nurses, and she went down there very much not knowing what she was about to be getting into.
Was she reluctant to speak with you?
She was remarkably open, and I really have to thank the people who did speak, like I said, about two dozen of them, to provide this information, because for many years there's been a lot of secrecy around Guantanamo and this whole interrogation and detention program that the country has had. So she and others did speak, and they had been warned that some of these people were very dangerous, could hurt them, and so I think it was a brave thing, but they wanted to share this particularly challenging experience. What was so interesting to me, our service members have had so many deployments in war zones in the last 15 years. Some of them told me that their time at Guantanamo was actually more challenging, more difficult, more stressful than even some of the war zone deployments.
Didn't detainees call Shay Rosencrantz names and dislike her? Why?
They did, and that was the case with many of the mental health providers. Again, they were seen as part of this effort to detain them. In some cases, many of the cases, the detainees felt like they were political prisoners. They had very little recourse in terms of challenging their detention on a legal basis. Again, we now know that there seems to be that many of them were either foot soldiers in the wars in Afghanistan and in the war on terror. They were sometimes mistakenly identified, and so many of them felt that they were being wrongly held and were very angry. There were others who were probably, you know, more committed enemies of the U.S., and so there were, you know, a lot of them did not look kindly upon the mental health teams. And then, of course, the big element, which is this lack of trust. In the early days, the medical information was being regularly accessed by the interrogation teams. So that trust between a doctor and a patient, especially a mental health provider, was really broken. And what we found, or what I found in reporting this, was that the effect of that lasted for many years.
And you write about the behavioral science consultation team, pronounced BISCIT. Did everyone on the team have access to the detainees' health records?
They did at first. And so these were the psychologists who were deployed not to provide mental health care, not with the patient as the center of their mission, but in fact, the psychologists that were to use their knowledge of psychology and mental health to help extract information from the detainees.
Isn't that a breach of patient confidentiality?
Well, many people, in fact, felt that way. And the Red Cross, in fact, the International Red Cross, which was down at Guantanamo in the early years, and wrote a scathing report that was then leaked. Usually the ICRC, the Red Cross, communicates directly with governments, but their conclusions about the violations of this, you know, confidentiality of medical information, the misuse of it, they have argued that that information was used in ways that that actually harmed detainees. The U.S. has denied that, but these are very serious problems, and in fact, there has been for many years a big debate and a big kind of backlash against those practices amongst doctors and you know, psychiatrists, psychologists, and medical doctors, culminating in a recent year in a very, very critical report done by the main body that represents psychologists, the American Psychological Association, which resulted for a while in all psychologists being pulled out of Guantanamo. They didn't even feel that their presence there, even in a caring role, was appropriate.
Can you tell us a little bit about the interrogation techniques that were used on these detainees? We know about waterboarding, but what were some of the other things?
As far as we know, waterboarding per se, I believe, I'm getting this correctly, that was not used at Guantanamo. But some of the people who went through the CIA prisons where it was being used did end up at Guantanamo in 2006 when those CIA prisons were closed. And so so certainly some of the people who these psychiatrists and psychologists are treating to this day have been through the most sort of brutal, terrifying techniques, interrogation techniques, and those have been banned, as you pointed out. They've been widely condemned, considered torture, considered against U.S. law. So some of the things that these men went through were horrifying, and even a few of the early interrogations at Guantanamo involved prolonged sleep deprivation, sensory isolation, sometimes really loud music playing. There were times where the detainee was taken somewhere, hooded, made to sort of believe that they would probably be killed. There was also this technique where they would be forced to stand for a certain amount of time in very stressful positions, many, many hours. Really, really difficult things that resulted in medical problems, things that resulted in some cases, at least one that I wrote about today, the death of a prisoner at a CIA prison. So they're really actually very horrible to hear about. As part of the series, I got to meet one of the former detainees who's now free, who never faced any charges, who went through those CIA prisons. And just to face him and to sit with him and hear about what he went through, which was also documented by our government. So it's, you know, these are pretty tough techniques. And the whole question of whether they even have any positive effect at getting intelligence out of people, that's been, you know, really widely disputed.
They were developed by the two psychiatrists you wrote about in today's paper, Bruce Jessen and James Mitchell, who are now being sued. Hadn't they based their ideas on brainwashing techniques that had been used by communists in previous wars?
These were two psychologists, yes, Mitchell and Jessen, and they based these techniques on prisoner of war sort of preparation for our service members. So we have these survival schools that our service members, the really elite ones who would be in danger of being captured by a regime that doesn't follow, you know, international law, that tortures people. So this was to try to help them be able to resist that. They would go through a very controlled exposure to some very, very harsh techniques. The main difference was when it was applied to detainees that we were holding, obviously they weren't thinking they were being trained. You know, they didn't, it just appeared to them as torture. But that was the idea. That was what the psychologists had come up with when, and one of them, that James Mitchell, has a book coming out this week where he's sort of telling more details of his story than he has previously.
Could the psychiatrists who were seeing these detainees in psychological sessions, see that the detainees came back from interrogations in serious distress?
This was one of the really surprising and disturbing parts, which was that the psychologists and psychiatrists on the side to try to care for the patients weren't allowed in some cases. They were told that they couldn't or felt that they couldn't ask the detainees about what they were going through in the interrogation program.
And the detainees didn't offer that information?
In some cases they did, but in a lot of cases they didn't. In fact, one of them who's written a book, Mohamedou Slahi, he recently was released. He said that after he went through a very harsh techniques at Guantanamo, he was very disturbed. He came back and he did see the mental health team, but he said in his book he didn't feel like he could tell them what happened. He was afraid of doing so. And so these psychologists and psychiatrists described to me feeling like they had, you know, according to them, no idea what was happening. Of course, in some cases, later on, those very harshest techniques weren't being used anymore. But they weren't even allowed to ask about things that might have caused PTSD, post-traumatic stress, which we know from, you know, torture survivors who've come to this country for asylum. We know that that is one of the main outcomes of going through torture, developing PTSD, post-traumatic stress. If you were a psychologist or psychiatrist at Guantanamo, some of them at least were told you can't ask about what might have caused that trauma that is now leading to the current psychiatric symptoms. So that was a problem too, and that's been really widely criticized by psychologists and psychiatrists who have evaluated some of these detainees for their defense teams.
Another issue you raise is suicide at Guantanamo. How common was prisoner suicide?
There have been, and I'm forgetting the number, I think it was 6 cases where the U.S. has called, might have been 4, no, 6, I think, where the U.S. has sort of concluded that detainees died from suicides. And there have been some critics who have challenged that and alleged that there have been, there are still some questions to be answered about those deaths. But there were many, many, many dozens of suicide attempts. And one of the biggest challenges of the job, and probably what caused there to be such a robust mental health team installed at Guantanamo, was the fact that there were all of these suicide attempts. And these psychiatrists and psychologists were in the position of trying to figure out, was that a real suicide attempt? Is that person actually suicidal for mental health reasons? Do they want to kill themselves to make a statement because they feel like there's no other way to challenge their detention? There were U.S. officials who called these suicide attempts and even the suicides acts of asymmetrical warfare. So here the psychologist or psychiatrist was trying to ferret that out. They were told that if there was a real attempt, that would be communicated all the way up to Defense Secretary at the time, Donald Rumsfeld. This was taken very seriously. So they were under a lot of pressure as to what to classify something as if a detainee, you know, found a way to hang themselves. Interestingly, those were not all called attempts. If they did it in front of a guard who was going to rush in and cut them down, that was sometimes called a suicide gesture. The other way that detainees would try to end their lives was by hoarding some of the medicine, in some cases the psychiatric drugs, and then taking that all at once and overdosing. So, in many cases, it may have been a real sign of the distress that they were going through. But this was one of the biggest challenges for the mental health teams.
You mentioned Mohamedou Ould Salahi, who wrote the Guantanamo Diary and spent 14 years in Guantanamo, was arrested with little evidence that he was tied to terrorist organizations, and his release was recommended a number of times. But nonetheless, he endured some of the worst treatment, sleep deprivation, exposure to extreme temperature, sexual assault by female interrogators. Why would someone like Salahi be kept in detention for all that time if it was kind of clear that he really didn't have much of a connection to terrorist organizations.
Well, we know that in the early years, and I mean, even to this day, Guantanamo is a bit of a legal black hole. Part of the reason it was set up was to, it was a space that I guess it could be argued legally, and I'm not a lawyer, that it was sort of outside of U.S. law. It's in Cuba. So it was very hard to kind of for somebody to get out of there. There were a number of releases. The Bush administration did release many hundreds of prisoners. There have been 800, roughly 800 in total, who have cycled through Guantanamo. But there were issues with finding placement for some prisoners who were found to be no threat. And then it was just very, very hard for these detainees to challenge their detention. Over the years, there have been a lot of lawyers involved in helping them. It was, you know, there have been some a Supreme Court ruling that did rule that they could challenge their detention under U.S. law. So there, but even so, it's been, you know, really hard for some of them to get out. So this has to do with the challenges of closing Guantanamo, certain obstacles that have been raised by those who are opposed to shutting it down.
And President Obama pledged to close Guantanamo when he was running for election the first time, but he hasn't been able to close the prison. Is it because there's nowhere for these prisoners to go? Is it because Congress is resisting? Is there a sense that since President-elect Donald Trump has said during his campaign that he might bring back waterboarding, that we might see Guantanamo for a very long time into the future?
That is a distinct possibility. So what Congress did was to block the transfer of, I believe, the money used to transfer prisoners there to the U.S. to face, you know, a trial or whatnot. So I understand that's one of the big challenges to closing Guantanamo. And then you're right, there are all sorts of unknowns with the president-elect, and in particular his speaking about bringing back techniques that have really been banned, have been determined by most people to have been torture, to have violated American law. And so there are a lot of question marks there. The Senate Intelligence Committee report, the executive summary was released in 2014. The Intelligence Committee really concluded that those techniques were harmful to the U.S., that they caused, you know, more harm, way more harm than they did good. So I think that there are a lot of issues out there for or challenges if the new president were to try to bring back some of those techniques. But as to whether Guantanamo could remain open for the future, this is a big possibility, and there are a lot of questions around what the next month, you know, what President Obama may do or not.
How many detainees are left in Guantanamo, and should we assume that almost all of them are suffering from some form of PTSD?
There are 60 left the last time I checked, which was about a week ago. And the percentage of the detainees who have mental health issues is not exactly known at this point. So I wouldn't be able to say for sure. But a number of them have difficulty, you know, sort of anxiety symptoms, difficulty sleeping, depression. One of the psychologists I interviewed said, you know, I would be depressed if I were in that condition. It's a not easy place to be in, especially when you really have all of that uncertainty about your future, at least in U.S. prisons, which can also be very challenging places. Generally, you're going to know what your fate is. So that's very, very hard for them to deal with psychologically.
Sherry Fink's article, Where Even Nightmares Are Classified Psychiatric Care at Guantanamo, was in the November 12th issue of the New York Times. Sherry, it's always a pleasure having you on our show.
Thanks so much. And people can find that at nytimes.com by putting in classified nightmares.
And
thanks so much.
And we also have a link to it on our show page at wnyc.org/Lopate.